Good afternoon. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Resources together. It is 1:16, and present are Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Feige, Representative Gardner, myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones. Today we are going to have a second hearing on HJR 8, opposing genetically modified salmon, HB 121, loan funds, charter mariculture, and microloan. Depending upon the discussion, the committee will decide whether to retain that for another hearing. And then we will go on to House Bill 106, Coastal Management Program. And so, Representative Kawasaki, you presented the bill earlier, and did you have any more statement before we go to public hearing?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I'll open public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify on HJR 8? Is there anyone online to testify on HJR 8? I'm going to close the public hearing. Committee discussion, and I believe we have an amendment, Representative Heron or Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Representative
Heron. I move amendment. Apparently, number one, it is LS0376/M.1.
So we have amendment number one before us. There's no objection. Are there any objections to the amendment? Anybody wish? I'm going to read it just so the listening public knows. It says, putting a new clause, whereas the applicant has already bred and produced transgenic salmon and shipped them for commercial market tests, semicolon, and. So that's another whereas. So is there any objection to amendment number one? Seeing no objection, amendment number one is adopted. Committee discussion. We have HJR 8 before us. Any committee discussion? Wishes of the committee? Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, I just think that we have so much invested in not only our salmon, but in our image and branding our salmon as being natural, sustainably harvested from clean waters, that the idea of any introduction, accidental or however, of this kind of genetically modified fish is just kind of terrifying to me. So I hope we pass this bill out.
Thank you. And Representative Kawasaki, we had an amendment that was M.1. Just to verify, do we have version A before us, or?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think version M. Yes. Was adopted.
Version M was adopted. I'm just looking for it here.
It was before. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So we are working on version M, and it's amended. Do I have any other further committee discussion? What's the will of the committee? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House Joint Resolution Number 8, Fisheries. That's 27LS0376/M, as amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And was that a zero fiscal?
It was a zero fiscal note, sir.
With attached zero fiscal note. Is there any objections? Seeing no objections. Committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 8 as amended. That's 27LS0376/M with the individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note removed from committee. And next we are taking up, and thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Next we are going to take up House Bill 121 and that is at the House rules by the request of the governor. Do we have the department representatives here? to present the bill. Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development for the state. House Bill 121 would create a suite of free new revolving loan funds that offer a helping hand to Alaska entrepreneurs and to help build their businesses and contribute to the state's economy. Revolving loan funds have a proven track record in the state and is currently administered within the Division of Economic Development Division, or in the financing section. They could make it easier for entrepreneurs to invest in business expansion and to stimulate economic activity. To incentivize development of the shellfish mariculture industry, to assist Alaska charter operators in acquiring HALBR permits to transition to the new regulatory and management regime instituted by NOAA, and to seed microenterprise development across the state. The Commercial Fisheries Revolving Loan Fund would provide access to capital for Alaska-owned charters, it would repatriate permits to Alaskans, and it would increase economic benefits to Alaska from this sector for recirculation of earnings into Alaska. It has also come to the Department's attention that an interest rate change in a previous committee or referral could conflict with the private sector loan program, and we're working with them now and will continue to do so as the bill moves through the process to rectify this conflict. As far as the microloan revolving loan fund would be the mariculture, it is to provide a spark to a growing industry with a great year-round potential for coastal Alaskan communities and entrepreneurs. Currently, there are 67 permitted farms in the state, but only 25 of them are producing, 10 in southeast Alaska and 15 in south central. It wasn't too long ago where British Columbia had a $500,000 economy in this sector. We have a $473,000 operation now. In 15 to 20 years, British Columbia has been able to turn that into a $30 million industry by seeding the development of these mariculture farms, and that's what we want to do here. The Microloan Revolving Loan Fund would help small businesses grow by providing loans to startup costs, working capital, inventory expansion, and other commercial purposes. Alaska is one of the few remaining states without a microloan program, a proven track record in other states and through the Small Business Administration. And last year, this very same bill passed the House 40-0, and we've packaged it with some other revolving loan funds this year. These programs would complement two existing small business loan programs administered by the Division of Economic Development, the Small Business Economic Development Revolving Loan Program and the Rural Development Initiative Fund, both which are geared towards long-term financing. Small businesses are the number one creator of private sector jobs, so this legislation would help us in our efforts to spur economic growth in Alaska. It'll be good for our economy and good for Alaska families. The department is on a mission to foster a business climate in this state that is conducive to job creation and economic growth. We have been actively engaged in examining how we operate in an effort to be more responsive to the needs of the business community and deliver services that are relevant and useful to the private sector. Recent realignment of our resources and services within the department have boosted the state's economic development toolbox and is helping us to aggressively reassert the state's role in creating a business-friendly environment in Alaska. We've spent a lot of time listening to the private sector. The commissioner recently formed an economic advisory task force comprised of industry leaders, and we have been instrumental in trying to reach out to the private sector. We've done this through NGOs, trade associations, the ARTRs, ANCSTA corporations, and legislators. A common heard theme has been increased financing operations for small businesses. Access to capital is critical. It is simply the difference by getting by and actually thriving. We believe HB 121 is a step in the right direction, and I urge your support in the passage of this legislation, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Does the committee have questions for the department? One that came up from constituents was the relationship and microloan between this and ARTRs, and can you explain to us what that relationship would be?
Currently, out of the 12 barters in the state, one does have a microloan program. It's in the Kenai Borough. We have been in discussions with them in the past of working together and possibly operating their fund. Right now, their fund is very successful. We would continue to work with the auditors individually and actually would prefer to see people go and work with the auditors first before they come to the state. But it is a program that we do not have for the majority of the state. Just one auditor right now is providing the microloan program.
So just for clarification, then, this wouldn't override or necessarily replace a microloan program from an auditor, but if an auditor wanted to work with the department in doing a microloan program, this would enable that.
Correct.
Okay, right. Thank you. Representative Wilson, and then Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The microloan program, if the auditor has a program and someone gets a microloan from them, can they then go to the state and get another one from the state then?
That actually is a technical question I'll call Lifeline of Juanetta Ayers, our director of Division of Economic Development.
And would you identify yourself on the record and then go ahead and address the question?
Thank you, Chairman Seaton. My name is Juanetta Ayers. I'm the director for the Division of Economic Development. In reference to Representative Wilson's question, it is conceivable that there could be circumstances where that would happen, but the borrower would have to achieve the collateral in order, have the collateral in place in order to make that possible. So they may have a project that would require something beyond the loan limits available with another borrower. But all of those things would have to be looked at with regard to that individual borrower, their circumstances, the project, and the kind of collateral that they could bring forward.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
All of the other ones, like shellfish, the charter fishermen, the commercial fishermen, and the mariculture are all water-related. Are the other ones can be any other kind of business?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Wilson, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So essentially a microloan is what financial institutions call pre-bankable.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, in terms of that specific definition, what I would say is that most of these borrowers would have yes, they would have issues by definition that they would have been turned down by an existing private lender, but that may be able to achieve the circumstances of the microloan fund in order to get to a credit decision.
Follow-up, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's how I understand it. So under this proposed legislation, so microloans are for individuals that have lack of collateral, which you've already mentioned. But what about employment and credit history?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, all of those factors would be taken into consideration by a loan officer, again, even before they would be taken to committee for a decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions in the department? Representative Feige and then Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that these loans would be made to people that have previously not qualified for commercial loans?
There was a turndown provision by a commercial institution before they go to the state, yes.
Follow-up, Representative Feige?
Yeah, so are these loans then inherently more risky than standard commercial loans might be? Is that generally the reason they've been turned down?
Yes, that would be correct.
So shouldn't the interest rates be perhaps higher than what you've indicated here to account for the risk?
Would you identify?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, you're correct that in the characterization that they would be riskier loans. That risk would be mitigated largely through collateral requirements. The interest rates are what would be common with other comparable microloan programs that are offered in other programs, other states, other jurisdictions.
So
Representative Feige.
Thank you. So I guess the what was going to be collateral that it will be acceptable to the commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that is standard language with regard to the other loan funds that the division currently operates. In the past, everything from real property, fishing vessels, gear and equipment, in some cases, inventory might be considered as well. But all of those things would be attached to specific value. They may be, again, based on the risk and the assessment of the loan officer, a determination about how much collateral would be required in order to achieve the loan. These are going to be relatively, you know, we're on a national average, the average microloan value is about 12 to $13,000. We're requiring anything above 35 to have the turn down. We expect that we would probably be close to or maybe slightly higher than that number.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I actually had a very similar question, so it's been answered. But I want to do a couple things. And one, thank you, and I don't know if this is standard always, but that each of the limitations on loans includes language that a person who has past due child support obligations can't get the loan. I'm very, very glad to see that. And I'm curious about the first part in Section 1 about at least 50% of the loan proceeds are to be used by the borrower for product quality improvement or energy efficiency upgrades if the improvements or upgrades use products manufactured or produced in the state. And I'm sort of curious about how to track that if somebody is, you know, doing upgrades and you know, if that's sort of part of the loan process. And also, as we establish a new loan program, I wonder how the sponsor would feel about having some sort of report to the legislature so that we can know how we're doing on getting repayments. So.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, with regard to the section that you referenced on the, we have several objective measurements with regard to whether or not things are manufactured in the state of Alaska. We have Alaska product preference statute to go to, and then we also have a Made in Alaska standard. There would be ways for borrowers to determine whether or not a particular vendor had achieved those standards. And then additionally, the loan office, that's guidance for the loan officers as well. So we think that there will be an objective measurement by which to determine that.
Thank you.
And both those programs are actually run by the Department of Commerce, too, Made in Alaska and Product Preference.
Thank you.
And through the chair, then, with regard to the reporting standard, we do provide an annual report that indicates loan origination and servicing activities, as well as performance standards such as default and delinquency. So that information is available.
Thank you.
Okay, and before we go to Representative Herron, I wanted to recognize that Representative Osterman has joined us in the room. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Juanetta, it'd be wonderful if we had a 100% return on all these microloans, but what are you predicting as the high end of success rate?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, we believe that it'll probably be in the 90-95% range. The national average, there's not, I would say there's not necessarily a definitive source, but there is a microcapital monitor that has estimated that the average default rate is about 5%. And so we would, and that actually tracks fairly well with our Small Business Economic Development Fund. So that's in general, we've looked at different numbers, 3 to 5%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. That was approximately what I was going to ask. But with our commercial fishermen revolving loan, what is our percentages there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have that specific number on the top of my head. In general, for last year, our default rate was less than 1% for the entire portfolio.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And we will now open public hearing. And we have in the room Paul Foos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thanks for hearing this bill. I'm Paul Foos, and I'm representing Pack Alaska Sea Farms. And I first went to work for them to help them try to untangle some extremely complex regulatory issues. But I came to believe so much in this industry and its potential that I actually bought into it and became a partner. So I am a part owner of one of these farms. And primarily focusing on gooey ducks. And we weren't sure it could actually be done up here. So about 8 or 9 years ago, we started putting in the seed for these farms. And now, just this last month, we had a successful harvest of farm gooey ducks. For the first time, this is an adult gooey duck, weighing about 1.5 or 2 pounds, ideal for the Chinese and Japanese market. There's a little bit of a market in the U.S. If you're a fan of sushi, that would be mirigai or long-neck clam on the menu. The timing of this loan program is good because we've actually proven the technology. We got to this point by people mortgaging their houses, draining their bank accounts. I mean, these were the true pioneers that went out to prove up this industry. The other thing is you see the term is fairly long in here for repayment, and that's because this gooey duck took about 7 years to grow, 6 or 7 years to grow to an adult size. So we wanted to, you can pass it around back if other people want to see it too. You know, the loan terms in here are balanced with the life cycle of these animals. And the reason why I think it's justified for the state to establish this program is it's hard for a bank to give you a loan when you don't have any, can't show any revenue coming in for 6 or 7 years. In addition, there are expenses of paying leases to DNR. We pay about $10,000 a year in leases to DNR. But I think another reason to do it is for the economic development. And Curtis Sayer gave you some numbers on overall harvest, but behind those numbers is everything else, the boat that you hired to go plant it, the mechanics that work on the boat, the people that you bought the fuel from. When we harvest, they go in, and processing plant in Ketchikan, custom processes them. This is a good off-season processing opportunity for them when the salmon aren't there, so it allows them to help keep their staff a little bit longer throughout the year. We buy the seed from the hatchery in Seward. That gets transported down. We put it on an airplane to ship it to Japan or China. So all throughout it, I mean, there's, you know, there's quite a chain of other people that are involved in the product, not just the farmer. So I think it is a legitimate economic development tool. It's needed. It will be used. And I can also, I just know from my experience, having been Commissioner of Commerce quite a few years back here, the Division of Investments, the loan programs for fisheries were very successful with a very low default rate, and we would expect the same with this.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Foos? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Let's go to Anchorage LIO. Sean Ruddy, are you online?
Yep, I'm online. I'm actually in Ketchikan right now.
Oh, and do you wish to testify on House Bill 121?
Correct.
Okay, would you go ahead and identify yourself, who you represent for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Sean Ruddy, and I do reside in Anchorage. I have a oyster farm, sea farm in Kachemak Bay, Halibut Cove. And I'm part of the Kachemak Shellfish Mariculture Association and the Kachemak Shellfish Growers Co-op. And I've been farming oysters for about 8 years. I see this as a very beneficial fund, especially for new farmers, to be able to get into the business. It does take a long time to get up to where you're actually profitable, and it takes a bunch of resources, including money, to make it happen. You know, I had to buy a boat, had to build my own boat, had to customize gear, had to get gear to hold the oysters on the farm. I have to pay my DNR fees, all the fees involved in the DEC, and the labor of working on the farm. And I believe this is a great loan fund, and I urge you to approve it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sean, for the testimony. Does anybody have any questions? Seeing none, again, thank you for your testimony. Let's Jerry Andrews, Anchorage, are you there or at another place and wish to testify on the bill?
Again, Mr. Chairman, I'm in Ketchikan with Sean, and it's my pleasure to have the opportunity to testify on House Bill 121. And to the committee and all the comments and testimony that Curtis Thayer presented earlier in this testimony is 100% right on. I thank him for his concise information that he brought from the department. In addition to that, I've owned Icy Bay Oyster Company since 2005 as a startup, and we haven't produced one oyster at this time. However, it's not that we didn't try. But one of the big hurdles that an individual like myself coming into the industry is, of course, the financing. One of the reasons that it slowed down us getting into production is because of financing and not having that that legacy of production, it's made it very difficult. So with that, we've changed our business plan. We're looking at purchasing a farm in Kachemak Bay and becoming a member of the Kachemak Bay Shellfishers Association and also the greater community of the Alaska Shellfishers group. So with that, we ask that your consideration of this House Bill 121 and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, for your testimony, and hopefully you'll be a constituent soon. Does anyone in the committee have a question? Okay, thank you for your testimony, and we'll go now to Megan Clark. Megan Clark, are you online?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House of Representatives. For the record, my name is Megan Clark. I represent Krabby Sisters. My company, Krabby Sisters, is a seafood company based out of Anchorage. We brought our product to market this past January, gluten-free Alaska King crab cakes. Over the last 2 years, we've developed a strong relationship with our local small business development center and have participated in over 40 hours of group trainings and seminars. Additionally, we routinely meet with our business advisor, specifically focusing on the development of our company's current financial analysis and future projections. Our market research and development and current production numbers demonstrate a high consumer and commercial demand for our product. This demand means growth and expansion. In order for us as a small local manufacturing business to achieve this growth, we will need a loan to meet our cash flow needs. Unfortunately, it has been our experience that despite our ability to demonstrate good character, capacity to repay, favorable market conditions, and previous small business experience, we are simply categorized as a startup, lacking revenue history, which is a red flag for the financial institutions. We believe that this microloan legislation would assist in breaking down this barrier to expansion, providing sufficient cash flow to grow our Alaska business at a healthy and steady pace. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Megan. Does anyone have any questions? Seeing none, we'll go to John Thede. Probably messed up the name. So, John from DNR, are you online?
Yes, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Did
you
identify yourself? I'm here for questions, though, however.
Oh, you're just here for questions. Does anyone have any questions for representative from DNR? Seeing none, thank you for being online. Tim Dillon. Tim, are you online, and would you identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, sir. This is Tim Dillon. I am the city manager for the city of Soldovia. I'm also the executive director for the newly formed Soldovia Holding Corporation. I'd like to testify on House Bill 121. The community of Soldovia, like many small coastal communities in Alaska, have had a struggling economy in years. Things are starting to come back, and this kind of an opportunity, this kind of a loan fund, would be a huge shot in the arm for a small community like Soldovia. I would encourage you to move this forward and hopefully get it ratified with House Bill 121. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Does anyone have a question for Tim Dillon? Seeing none, That's all I have on the list. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 121?
Yes.
No one else in the room? Is there someone else online that would like to testify?
Yeah, my name's Adam Galindo with Taco Loco. I'd like to testify.
Okay, and would you say who you're associated with again for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, my name's Adam Galindo. I represent Taco Loco Products here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a strong supporter of House Bill 121, largely, in fact, as we're an established business, we're probably one of Alaska's largest food manufacturers here. We also are having a hard time securing capital to grow the business, create jobs, without, you know, I'm being told 12% interest, 35% down. I mean, just all kinds of crazy terms with banks that we've dealt with for years and years. It's just, you know, the economic times we're in is just, I think, putting a crunch on a lot of Alaska businesses and manufacturers all through the state. So, yes, I'm a strong supporter of it and would like to see it make out of, get ratified and out of committee and, you know, move on with this process.
Thank you, Adam. And would you spell your last name for the record here? We don't have it on the
Sure. It's G-A-L-I-N-D-O.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else online? No one else online, no one else in here to testify on 121. We'll close public testimony. Committee discussion, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe DNR, but I'm not sure who I need to talk or ask the question, but are we using the funds that are in the commercial fishing revolving loan to get this started? I can't remember because I know that sometimes some of their extra money is put into the and used in the general fund, and I was just wondering how it was working.
Okay, and since Department of Commerce administers those under the Division of Investments, so we'll get them. Would you identify yourself again on the record and then go ahead with that.
Thank you, Chairman. Winnetta Ayers, Director for the Division of Economic Development. In response to Representative Wilson's question, the answer is no, that is not a part of the proceeds from the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund.
And so is this going to be coming from the general fund?
That is the current fiscal note, yes.
Okay, and I couldn't find a fiscal note. That's why I didn't have any. What is the fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, is it in regards specifically to one of the loan funds or no, all just, of the loan funds?
Mm-hmm. Just in, to the bill.
To the bill. So the capitalization for each one of the loan funds currently is $3.5 million for the microloan fund, $5 million for the halibut commercial charter sport fish loan fund, and $3 million for the mariculture loan fund. And then there's also a separate operating cost.
She's talking about that.
Which I regret I don't have in my folder.
Okay. And Representative Wilson, Representative Feige has it. It's $169,000 is operating expenses on fiscal note number one. And for the first year, or 2012, and it's approximately the same amount in each succeeding year. Yes.
Okay, I just don't have to.
Okay, we'll get a copy of that. And Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Ms. Ayers. Can business people involved in mariculture or the commercial charter fisheries have access to the current funds, $3.5 million? Is that already in place? And are they able to take loans out of that fund?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, there is not currently something that is designated for these specific activities with regard to mariculture or sport fish. With regard to microloans, we do have two funds that are more designed for long-term financing, small business economic development, and rural development initiative fund. However, both of those funds have certain restrictions, geographic restrictions, and other complications with regard to the management of those funds based on those federal requirements that make it difficult to lend on a statewide basis.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there further questions? We are getting copies of the fiscal note, but they're not here yet. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just listening to the people that have been testifying, it sounds like there's a fair amount of difficulty getting standard financing through normal commercial channels. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of loath to put the state in a position of being the bank, although I do recognize that in this case it probably does have a certain degree of merit. And just because it puts us in a position of competing against banking institutions. Is it, just to sort of poll the committee, is there any kind of, would it be wise to put some kind of a sunset on this? And perhaps Mr. Thayer would have comment on that. Keeping in mind that although economic times may be tough currently, you know, in 10 years, things may be pretty rosy.
And this committee discussion, so does anybody? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Well, what I'm thinking about here is that we do have the commercial fishermen's revolving loan. However, their boat is what's the collateral, and so you're usually or maybe a permit or something. But, of course, they're going to do everything they can because they don't want to lose their boat. But in these, it is a little bit different here because they're not going to I don't know how it would be for someone. I should have asked the fellow that was in Anchorage. I was going to ask him if he how often he had to come back here to work on his farm down here, how many times a year that had to happen, because that would be the extra cost too. But they don't have any profit for like 7 or 8 years. And I just don't know what it would be like for what's the collateral? What is the collateral? I know they have to have these pens and everything that they're working on, but that's not, I mean, if they lose the pen, I don't know how, you know, for commercial fishermen, I know that they don't want to lose their boat because that's their only livelihood. With this, they're usually people that have maybe other livelihoods or are already retired, and they want to do this as an investment. So I don't know what the difference would be. So if maybe somebody can make a comment on that.
And Representative Wilson, just to clarify, lots of times, you know, the loan, the collateral is not just the boat. It's your house. If you have any apartments, mm-hmm. if you have, you have to have, in fact, oftentimes they don't even care if the boat's there because you have to have other collateral for the backup on that. And I guess, you know, for the committee is looking at this is a revolving loan fund. Mm-hmm. So if we make it as a termed revolving loan fund, then the expectation of the industry to be able to develop and being able to foresee that's going to be there. I think, you know, just my own opinion is the legislature at any time, and we've done this on different programs, we've come back in on, in fact, the commercial fishing vessels, we've come in and said, you know, that program is competing now with the private sector. At one point we came in and we made adjustments. So the legislature at future times can come in and make adjustments to the program. But I think the long-term stability of knowing that there is a program there, if you're considering getting into it, would, I think there is enough time delay by the time you have to go through your DNR permitting and get fish and game and all of those things set up even before you're needing the loan. And if that was sunset, the program was sunsetting, I think that previous to the sunset, people aren't going to be able to make those kind of business decisions because they know the loan is or the program sunsetting. So that would be my only thought there, but there's nothing in a revolving loan fund that prevents the legislature in the future from coming in and adjusting interest rates, which we've done several times in the last several years, as well as other parts of the program. Mm-hmm. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the way I look at it is, you know, the question I had, is this a pre-bankable model? And it is. Now, if Juanetta had would have said that our repayment rates may fall below 90%, then I would have great concern. But if it's really between 95 and 97% repayment rates, I think we should look at it in a positive way and not look at it overly critically, because the important part in this repayment plan is the borrowers. And I think it is an important finance method that we should deploy. Thank you.
Further question. Did you want the department up, or was the committee?
Does the department have an opinion on that, whether they should, we should add a sunset date to this, however far out in the future?
Would you identify yourself again, Curtis?
Curtis Thayer, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development.
And restating the question, it was, would the department support putting a sunset to the program in the bill?
If it was the will of the legislature, then obviously we would, for the success of the loan program moving forward. However, we have worked with CFAB and the banking community as this was drafted and brought forward to be very careful that we're not being competitive with the private sector.
Recording stopped.
You're done now, Curtis.
Yeah. Blew up the electronics. Yeah. We'll just be at ease for just a moment.
I think we're okay.
What are we? Are we taking a test to see whether?
We're fine. We're here. We're back.
Okay. Okay. We're back on in order. Did you have a response? I forgot where we were.
Curtis here with the Department of Commerce. What I had indicated was we would like to see this bill move forward. We would entertain a sunset provision.
This meeting is now over. Thank you for calling.
Are we still online? Okay, we're still online.
Okay. Are we doing it again? Are you picking up?
Okay. We would enter.
And we, Representative Munoz, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I really like this bill. I heard it at the beginning of the session in one of our budget subcommittees, and I really like that the governor is trying to address specific issues of the funding problems that certain industries have in our state, and I think it's very positive. I was curious. Let's see. Earlier, too, in this committee. In the Resources Committee, we heard from the Shellfish Association that the first years of production are very cost intensive and that they don't derive income from those operations until the seventh or eighth year out. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if the loans specifically to mariculture farmers would take that into account.
It does, and they may defer their interest for up to 6 years. That would be subject to an arrangement with the Division of Economic Development with the loan officer, and that was addressed actually in the Fisheries Committee prior to it, is whether it would be deferred or may be deferred.
Okay. Okay, great. And then one more question. On the cost, it shows $169,000. In the first years, would that be a general fund cost to the general fund, or would that be assuming revenue from the fund in the first years of operation?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that would actually be through the fund. The fund itself would be paying for those.
So immediately within the first year, in 2012, you anticipate interest gain, payback, and revenue generation that soon? That just seems really early to
actually
me.
Actually, 2012 and then into 2013. So. Okay. Yes.
All right. That was it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Okay. Seeing no further questions, what's the will of the committee?
I'll move it. Let's see if I can find it.
First of all, before we do that, I want to check. Is there any committee member that feels that they want to hold this for a second hearing? Okay. Representative Munoz?
Okay. And just for clarification, we are looking at version D?
That's correct.
The CS. Okay. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill 121, version D, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, House Bill 121, version D, will move from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. And we will set that aside. And now we have the House Bill 106, Coastal Zone Management, before us. And we have a presenter today. And Mr. Gray, would you come forward? And there was questions that we've previously asked of how the program works, and a flow charts to lead us through the how the program works. So we have Mr. Gray, who has worked in the state previously on this issue, but has been a consultant for several years. So would you just give us a short rundown on your background before you start your presentation? But this is so that everyone understands, this is a presentation from the he's a consultant to some of the districts, so it's from the perspective of the consultants. And we, if we wish, at the end of this, we can get the department up there to give us their perspective as well, in case it's at all different. So, Mr. Gray.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Seaton, Co-Chair Feige, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Gray, for the record. I've worked 11 years in the Division of Governmental Coordination, coordinating oil and gas reviews, primarily mineral reviews. And for the past 7 years, I've worked for coastal districts throughout the state. I'd like to say up front, I don't have any gooey ducks to pass out, but I hope I'll have some information. I can clear up some misunderstandings. Let me get to the next slide. The coastal management program is complicated in some respects.
Hold one moment. Representative Feige,
you said you worked 11 years for the state?
Yes.
And what was the acronym that you used?
Well, I worked for the Division of Governmental Coordination, which was the Coastal Management Program at that time, is where it sat in the governor's office.
Okay. How come you're still not working for the state?
Well, I'm working as a private individual now, so.
Okay.
The ASMP, I think there's a lot of confusion about it, but I think we can really simplify it. And first of all, by saying that it's really a development program. It is now, and it always has been. It's a way to make projects better. Very few projects have ever been stopped through the program. It's a one-size-fits-all process. So a large project, a huge mine or a huge oil and gas development, it's going to follow the same process that you see before you on this slide. One of the, I think, good parts of the program is the pre-application services that the Department of Natural Resources gives. And that's a voluntary thing, but when an applicant would like, the department will hold pre-application meetings, and that can get everybody around the table to try and fix any problems there might be before the applications are even submitted. And then when there's a complete packet, which includes all permits except for DEC permits, since they're carved out of the program, but as soon as there's that complete packet, the review begins on what's called day one. And all reviews will either go through a 30-day review or a 50-day review. It's a little misleading because you can extend the reviews up to 90 days or longer for some types of reviews. But they're either under that 30-day schedule or 50-day schedule. The first milestone is on day 13 or day 25, and that's when one of the review participants can request additional information. So if for some reason there wasn't information in that startup packet, they can request that information. And that doesn't happen for every review. And then the next deadline is the comment deadline. Day 17 of a 30-day review, day 30 of a 50-day review. And that's the time frame when all state agencies, federal agencies if they'd like to weigh in, coastal districts, or the applicant if they'd like to provide comments. They all have to provide it on the same date. Then the Department of Natural Resources, or if it's a single agency review, one of the other departments, will develop a proposed consistency determination. And when you hear the word consistency, that sounds a little confusing. But what it means is that this review is to determine whether or not that project is consistent with the statewide standards of the ACNP and the district, the coastal district enforceable policies. So that's why it's called a consistency review. So the one of the departments that's coordinating the review will come out with this proposed determination. And you'll see the little dotted line up to an elevation because very few projects are elevated to the DNR commissioner. Pre-2003, that would have been the divisions of the three resource agencies first and then the commissioners. But now under the new program, it's the DNR commissioner. So if there are no elevation requests, it'll go directly to the final consistency determination on day 30 or day 50.
Okay. We have a couple of questions here. Representative Feige
and
Representative Wills.
On your elevation statement there, are they not getting elevated simply because the pre-application things that companies have to go through are just that much more clearer than they were prior to 03? Or is it because there's somebody in DCOM is simply choosing not to elevate them?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, it's the review participants decide whether or not to elevate that proposed decision. And my understanding is before 2003 or now, it was less than 1% of the projects would even be elevated or appealed in any way. So it's a very small number, and that's because this process is designed to identify the problems early on and to resolve them. Even if you don't have a pre-application meeting, it's designed to address those problems during the review.
Representative Wolf.
Questions. When you started out, you said one size fits all. Is that good or is that bad?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, in my particular, speaking just for myself, I think if we had a process for large projects, that would solve a lot of the problems with the program because, you know, 90%, maybe 95% of the projects aren't controversial. But those 5% are sometimes the larger projects, and it's kind of hard to do a cookie-cutter process.
So it would help if there were two different ones?
I believe so. And some states do that. I believe British Columbia does that. So it's not unheard of to have a large project process.
Okay, and then the second one, I'm not sure I understand for sure what elevation means. What would cause, I know that someone asks for the elevation, but what causes that? I mean, because people just don't understand or they don't have enough information or there's an argument or what causes it?
Through the chair, part of the process when you come up with that proposed determination are what they call alternative measures. These are pretty similar to permit conditions or permit stipulations. So I think the purpose of that elevation, if somebody thinks that there are greater impacts to coastal uses and resources and that those measures, those stipulations, don't really mitigate those impacts, that would give them the opportunity to say this is not consistent with the program.
Okay, so is there a stated amount of time that the DNR commissioner has to deal with that?
Yes.
Or can that be stopped? I mean, does that stop the project?
And through the chair, that 50 or 30-day timeline, it stops on the day that that elevation begins, but there is a timeline where they have to complete the elevation process. Yes.
So do sometimes the project get stopped right there?
Through the chair, yes. Very rare, but it does happen.
Okay. Representative Feige.
The companies, the entities, if you will, that make it through the pre-application, the permit application process, the 18-page questionnaire and all that, they seem to go through the, if less than 1% of them are getting elevated, then they seem to go through the process just fine. Now, you said before 03, there weren't that many, very small number that were getting elevated as well?
Through the chair, that's correct. My understanding is less than 1%, and I don't know what the percentage is under the new program, but under the old.
How many of those applications prior to 03 were actually withdrawn during the process? And why were they withdrawn?
Through the chair, I really don't have those figures, but I would say very few.
Really?
I used to coordinate some of the elevations, and I can only think of one or two that I coordinated that were withdrawn.
Okay, we saw some numbers from DECON showed a fairly significant number of applications that have been withdrawn.
And through the chair, I would go with their figures. I don't really have those calculations in front of me. I'm really basing it on 7 years ago, my experience.
Do we have further questions on that slide before we go on? So, yes, Representative Munoz.
Thank you.
Can you go back to the other
sure.
slide?
On this slide, could you tell me the difference between a 30-day review and a 50-day review?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Munoz. Each permit that triggers a consistency review will have either a 30-day timeline or a 50-day timeline. If you have three permits, two are 30-day, one is 50-day, then you would do the 50-day review.
Okay.
So it's the lowest common denominator that would determine that.
Is that off the ABC list?
And now we'll get a little bit more complicated. There is something called the A and B list. Those are types of projects that have minimal impact that are already found consistent. So if it's the activities are all on either the A or B list, you wouldn't even do a consistency review because it's already done once.
So that's kind of like a general permit and those things that are fall within that same scope. Same kind of project, if that's been found to be or placed on one of those lists because they don't have impacts that are outside of the enforceable policies or the statewide standards, then those wouldn't go through this process.
And that's correct. It's similar concept as a general permit, and actually general permits are automatically put on the B list, I believe. So they encompass general permits.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
Yes. Would you go back and answer that question again that Representative Munoz said or asked, because I didn't get it all.
And
I think that was a question of 30-day permit or a 50-day permit. Why would one?
So there is a list of permits that will trigger a consistency review. Not everything is reviewed for consistency. And on that list, it'll say whether that permit is a 30-day review permit or a 50-day review permit. So that'll determine which process you go under.
Further questions on that slide? Okay, let's proceed.
From my perspective, the two primary benefits of the Coastal Zone Management Program is first that the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act gives states perhaps more rights than any other environmental law I can think of. The ability to influence federal decisions far surpasses anything I can think of. So that's the first one. And the second one is it gets everyone around the table. As it is now, each state agency, each federal agency, they have their own permit process. And generally, those are going to operate in isolation. Same with the local governments. If they have their Title 29 permit, everyone does their own thing. So the potential of this program is to bring everyone around the table and to try to identify issues early on in the process and to solve them, find solutions that will work for everyone. Another benefit I see is that when you get everyone around the table, you might have similar permit stipulations. Rather than each agency coming up with something slightly different, which happens, you at least have the opportunity to sit around the table and work out the issue, have a common requirement for the industry. So the review participants have a little bit extra status. They're able to ask for that additional information in the last slide. So that includes affected coastal districts, the three resource agencies, DNR, Fish and Game, and DEC. It's designed to have DEC there, but I believe my understanding is in practice DEC isn't usually at the table. And then the any state resource agency that requests participation. And the applicant has special status too, of course, because they drive the process.
Okay, and before you, Representative Feige,
what advantages are there for the applicant? I mean, I understand the applicant, the idea of having everybody around the table, but is there any advantage in the system for the applicant?
And through the chair, my understanding is some applicants would prefer to go each agency individually, but many applicants really would benefit from this, having everyone around the table at one time. I can think of some reviews, for instance, that didn't require an environmental impact statement. And it was interesting because we would get federal agencies showing up at these meetings because this was their only venue to really talk about this project with other state and federal agencies.
And follow up, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Seems to me that one of the primary advantages for an applicant is that it does have a timeline, mm-hmm. that basically the system as it is encourages it to be completed in a timely manner. So if you're trying to execute a project, there's a fixed amount of time that you can plan into your economics, into your process, you know, within the applicant. Is that not a benefit?
And through the chair, I would agree, and it reminds me that I forgot to say an important point. Under this system we have is the agencies cannot issue permits until the review is completed. But what this does is it does give a timeline, and a pretty strict timeline, with the 90 days that the legislature has put there to come up with a solution. And under most circumstances, not all, state agencies must issue their permits, I think, within 5 days or so, unless there's a disposal of state land interest, things like that. So it also is coordinated with the permit process, although it isn't necessarily coordinating the permits themselves.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When all the coordinated agencies get together, and because of the DEC carve out, they don't. But if they have permits that have to be issued for the project, is that going on at the same time? Or I guess what I want to say is the whole process faster now? Or was it faster before?
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, and I don't know the answer whether or not it's faster or not, but my understanding, and the committee may have some misinformation on this, my understanding is that the DEC process is independent. Before, it would have to start at the beginning of the ACMP process. Now I believe it's independent for their permits. You know, they just issue them when they issue them.
Representative Wilson.
So is that usually after this whole process is over, or is it during this process?
And through the chair, I believe it would generally be afterwards.
So it would make it longer then, wouldn't it?
And through the chair, I don't know, maybe industry can answer that question. I would think theoretically it should make it shorter if you coordinate it.
Can you find that out?
Yeah, we'll ask that question. Representative Munoz and then Feige.
Thank you. So you're going through the 30-day or the 50-day process, and if you get through the process and you find that a project has an aspect to it that's not consistent with one of the policies or with, you know, one of the departmental requirements, what happens then?
Usually at that point, the applicant will voluntarily ask the clock to be stopped.
Okay.
And if it's something that cannot be worked out, they would either withdraw the project or have the agency find it inconsistent. Again, normally it's found consistent. There's a way that they can put a measure into that project to make it consistent.
I see.
There are a few projects that aren't. And in my experience when I used to coordinate elevations, a lot of them were on the Kenai River. because they destroyed king salmon habitat. Those are the type of projects that I recall were withdrawn because they just couldn't be found consistent.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What exactly goes on in the pre-application meetings and where it says complete packet? Seems to me there's some kind of a requirement. Applicants go online and they fill out a questionnaire that's, I guess, fairly extensive, about 18 pages or so.
And through the chair, it's mostly a checklist. So it's it looks extensive, but it's if you are familiar with the form, it's not that difficult. It's a checklist to determine what permits might be needed. That's one of the purposes. The other is they sign a certification saying this project is consistent. And most applicants are required to have a consistency analysis. In fact, the law requires that. My understanding is sometimes they just fill out a little checklist on that, too.
Feige, follow up.
So I assume there's back and forth between the departments or back and forth between DECOM with the applicant as they're putting their packet together?
Through the chair, and it all depends on the complexity of the project. Some projects, there is none. They just submit it, the coastal project questionnaire, the application packet, and the review starts. It's the larger projects where you normally would have a pre-application meeting. And sometimes pre-application can last a year or more. Again, that's voluntary on the aspect of the applicant. They can request it. They don't have to.
Okay, and so the packet is essentially the application is complete, and then the clock starts,
right?
So DECOM would have basically all the information that they require right at day one.
And through the chair, theoretically, although just in case some issues come up later, that's where you have the request for additional information.
Representative Herring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One request to the chairs and then one question to Mr. Gray.
I'm sorry.
The question to the chairs is it's my understanding that the DEC permit process is supposed to be concurrent with DNR's process. And so if there's a question or concern about that, the request to the co-chairs is that we find out if what that record is. But I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is to Mr. Gray is, so I was going to bring this up when we talked about the carve-out later, but since it was brought up in this series of questions, the DEC carve-out, really there's only one air quality permit application that is, I guess, the boogeyman here. Isn't that the prevention of significant deterioration? And the other air qualities would probably be appropriate to be within the consistency review, not outside of it?
And through the chair, from my experience pre-2003, it was just that one permit that was the problem. And that was for some major oil and gas developments. And it was because, my understanding is that application actually had to have drawings of the facilities. And whereas every other agency was ready to begin the review, sometimes the applicants wouldn't have those drawings. So I believe that could be fixed easily, just in regulation even, by just saying that the review can begin before they have a complete application for that PSD. Now, you could still review the issues related to that application without having a specific complete application. And to my knowledge, that was the only application where that was really a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and just for clarification, Representative Herring, your question was, is it required that the DEC permit, even though it's carved out, start and be going concurrently with the consistency review process?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that whoever provide that information to the co-chairs on the track record. Yes.
Okay. So we'll get both the track record and what the requirement is so that we understand. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
So what the essentially is, it would be good to add DEC for all of the permits except the one air permit to the coordinating agency that gets together with the applicant, so that everything would be talked about except that one air permit that gives the problem, and then that would be done separately as it goes along. Is that what you're saying?
That's the request in question, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Any other questions? Proceed. Thanks.
Thank you. There are basically four different types of reviews. I won't get into the details unless you have questions, but there are reviews that only have state authorizations. So you can think of an authorization like a permit, but sometimes it's not a permit. It's just something an applicant has to have before and go ahead. So that's why the term is used, authorization. When there's a federal authorization, there are some the federal regulations for the Coastal Zone Management Act will kick in. Still, it's that same process we saw on the first slide. And then there are federal activities. These are the kinds of things where there isn't an applicant, an oil and gas lease sale, or let's say the Army Corps of Engineers wants to dredge a harbor. That's considered a federal activity. And then for outer continental shelf projects, that's a little different because you don't review the permit applications. You review the exploration plan or the development and production plan. I'm getting a little into the weeds, but this is where it gets a little more complicated. You have that same process, but depending on the type of review, you might have some different factors that go into the mix. No questions? I'll go on.
Okay. So just
okay, Representative Feige.
So no matter what all these timelines, and your note at the bottom says the statutory timeline overrides all the federal timelines?
And through the chair, yes. The legislature's 90-day timeline, even if it's a large project and there were a lot of issues that aren't resolved, that review has to complete in 90 days, unless it's one of the few exemptions. There are some exemptions to the 90 days, and I believe some of them are disposal of land use, something like that.
Okay, but again, that timeline starts when the complete application is received.
That's right, when it's determined to be complete, yes.
Okay. Okay, further questions? Okay.
Again, one of the, I'll repeat this again because this really is the whole gist of the consistency review process. It's to determine whether or not the project is consistent with the statewide standards, which are in regulation at 11 AAC 112, and the coastal district enforceable policies. And at the same time, the agencies are coordinating their permit review. But the consistency review technically is just about consistency with these enforceable policies, statewide standards. Now, where it gets a little bit tricky is after 2003, when DNR implemented the new regulations, they had a requirement that the policies must flow from only one of these statewide standards you see here, not all of them, just the ones listed, or the designated areas. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through it, but just to be really clear, so those enforceable policies are limited to coastal impacts to just these topics.
Is there a topic that they're missing?
I don't see minerals there anywhere. So mineral development would be one. When the standards were revised, they removed the mineral statewide standard was changed to a sand and gravel standard that only applies to a coastal areas, the right near the saltwater areas. And if you look at 4640.020, the legislative objectives, they're much broader than these limits right here. So there's probably quite a bit missing, I would say.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Legislative objectives are broader than these standards. So does that mean that the regulatory process, the regulations, limited what the legislation actually permitted?
Through the chair, that Representative Gardner, that would be what I would assert, yes, absolutely. And I'll get to this, I think, maybe in one of the next slides, but the DNR has said that the regulations are more stringent than what the legislature intended, and I'm not sure that's ever been clarified, but at least in my understanding, this would be one of the reasons why it's more stringent. At this point, you have a yellow, bright yellow paper in front of you, and that is something I just put together this morning. I went through all the policies and counted them statewide, and I think it's, I neglected to keep one myself, but I think something like 62% or 63%, thank you, are just for two of those topics. So that's, 63% of them, at least according to the figures I came up with, are recreation or coastal development. So some of the important issues that would be more important to coastal districts, perhaps state agencies, important habitat, mining, natural hazards, subsistence, you know, look at the percentages there. There are very few enforceable policies for some of the issues that are the biggest concern to people around the state.
Good. Thank you, and Representative Feige.
Going down to your mining at the bottom there, seems to be mining is regulated fairly heavily both at the state and federal level. It seems like you're implying that mining is not somehow not regulated?
Through the chair, no, I didn't mean to imply that. Through the coastal management program, a coastal district isn't able to develop a policy specifically to mining for a local concern. If there's something locally they want to concern, they would be precluded from doing that. It's not to say that other agencies don't have regulations, and each, it depends who the landowner is, which regulations or statutes would apply. So it's not anything that's uniform.
It's uniform across the state.
Reverend Feige?
Mining regulations are uniform across the state, aren't they?
Well, and through the chair, my understanding is that, for instance, if it's on state land, certain regulations and statutes would apply. If it's on a federal land, a different set would apply. So, and someone may be able to correct me when I'm done, but my understanding is it depends a lot on who the landowner is. And some state permits do apply to federal land, some do not. I won't go through all of these statutory requirements, but they're pretty good right there. You can't duplicate state or federal law. You can't unreasonably restrict the use of state concern, mining, oil and gas. There's a whole list of them. Clear and concise. It must be prescriptive. I'll just spend a moment on that because I do think that's problematic. And if I could give an example, maybe. I looked at a policy this morning. Said something to the effect that floating facilities must be moored in a minimum of 12 feet of water during mean lower low water or 0.0 tide stage. Now, that's a prescriptive policy. And maybe it works, but sometimes industry prefers what's called performance-based. And if I was to rewrite that as a performance-based, it might be something like floating facilities shall be designed so they do not ground in tidal areas. So that's the objective you're trying to get to. And I think the idea behind the performance space is maybe the industry has a better way of reaching that same objective than your prescriptive policy does. So at least from my perspective, that's a problem, whereas the rest of these, if they were implemented with a simple common understanding interpretation of what the statute says, it wouldn't necessarily be a problem.
Okay, before we go on, Representative Munoz,
thank you. To follow up on Representative Feige's question, mining projects go through the ACMP process. It's just that, according to this, the local districts cannot establish enforceable policies pertaining to those projects. Is that correct?
And through the chair, they can't establish a policy that specifically addresses impacts from mining. They might have a policy on subsistence if they were allowed. I think they're only three statewide.
Okay.
Or one of the other matters, and that would apply to the mining project if those activities fit that enforceable policy. Now, the last one you hear a lot about is the policies must address a local concern. And that means it's sensitive to development of a unique concern to the coastal district. Those two aren't a problem. The problem has been in the interpretation of not adequately addressed by a state or federal law. In the next slide, I talk about that a little more. And this is where I believe the DNR's regulations are more stringent, or at least their current interpretation of the regulations. I should back up a bit, is that what I understand DNR is saying now is that a policy cannot address a matter that a state or federal agency could address, whether or not they have a regulation to address that. And I believe the audit said the same thing, but my understanding is that that's not quite correct. If you look at the 2005 program description, ACMP program description that was approved by the federal government, so that's what's being funded right now through the federal government, they specifically said that policies can address a matter as long as it's not specifically addressed in a regulation. There's a 2004 Attorney General memorandum that basically says the same thing, specifically about DNR area plans. It says a district can address the same matter in that area plan. That's something DNR has authority for. But they can have the policy as long as that area plan isn't incorporated into regulation. So it's, if it's not enforceable, then the district can have a policy. So there's a bit of confusion about this, and I believe there's some misinformation being spread around about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so if an agency, which Fish and Game, DEC, whatever, if they are already regulating that particular activity statewide, I think all it says under the ACMP is that subdivisions of the state cannot step on the toes of the state agency that's already regulating that particular activity, correct? I think that's what your note here at the bottom says. It says districts may establish policies for matters not already addressed in regulation.
And through the chair, I believe it would be your definition of the word matter. And as I believe my interpretation of that program description would say that the regulation has to specifically address that, not just that the agency could, but it has to be specifically addressed. And unless it's preempted by state or federal law, I believe according to what the statute says and even the regulation, that a district would be able to address that as long as they met the other district plan criteria.
Follow, Representative Feige.
Okay, so if an agency decides that something is regulated, if they decide to regulate something, that's one thing. But if they may also make a conscious decision to not regulate something, perhaps because it doesn't need to be regulated, then that's still within their authority to do that, correct?
And through the chair, it is with their authority, but my understanding of what the laws say is that the district would still be able to address that unless they were preempted for some other reason from doing that. Maybe I could give a quick example. I don't think it would be within a district's power to set game limits for Fish and Game. That's something that Fish and Game has, I mean, they've got that wrapped up. So if they're preempted from doing that.
We're not talking about other agencies. We're talking about municipalities and coastal districts trying to regulate things that are otherwise under the authority of some other agency.
And through the chair, that's correct. And okay. So I was trying to say that the coastal district could not have a policy on Fish and Game take, because that's something they're preempted from doing it. But for things where they're not preempted, let's say impacts to habitat, I don't believe they're preempted from that. A district would be able to have a policy on fish habitat, let's say. There are only two statutes on fish habitat, unless it's a special area. And they're fairly limited statutes. They don't really address any specifics about that fish habitat. And so it would be my interpretation that it would be all right for a district to have a policy, as long as it didn't conflict. You can't conflict with a state or federal law, but you can add to it.
Representative Wilson.
I want to go back and get some clarification on page 5.
Mm-hmm.
So the areas that are listed here are the only subjects that can be covered. Is that what you're saying?
Through a district enforceable policy, or actually through the consistency review, yes. Although there are a few additional standards that aren't listed in that left-hand column. So all of the statewide standards and then the district enforceable policies, that's your parameter of what you do in a consistency
okay.
review.
And so, I'm looking at the example that you just gave, and it says important habitat. Wouldn't worrying about the habitat be, couldn't you put it under that subject area?
And through the chair, yes, if you could get your important habitat areas approved. It's my understanding statewide there are only three districts that have areas, and they're very small areas. Juneau perhaps has the biggest areas. They have, I believe, 11 policies. Craig and Thorne Bay have one each. That's it for important habitat in the entire state as far as what a district has been approved
and
to designate.
Representative Wilson.
Can you give me an example of what some of those are?
Yes, and I don't have it in front of me, but I believe Craig, it's an area around eelgrass beds. In Thorne Bay, it's five or six rivers, 100 feet buffer, something like that. In Juneau, it's part of the Juneau Wetlands Management Plan, and I'm sure Representative Munoz is familiar with that. And some of the wetland types are considered important habitat. So you can go on the website and see specifically. But they're very small areas.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Juneau, it's because they have a general permit for the wetlands, and so that's why that's covered.
And through the chair, and also through the ACNP review, they have important habitat designated and 11 policies, 11 of the 13 policies that have been approved for important habitat. So if it goes through a review, it would be reviewed for consistency with those policies.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson, then Feige.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm trying to was it early on in the state's history that Juneau and some of these other areas got those permits and are designated areas, and lately we haven't been doing it? Can you kind of go into that a little bit?
And through the chair, my understanding is the Juneau Wetlands Management Plan is fairly old. It predates the changes to 2003. Mm-hmm. So what they tried to do is to make that Wetlands Management Plan part of the coastal program, and it didn't quite fit right, but they've done the best they can. Originally, it was disapproved, but through mediation, it's my understanding, is they did come to some agreement to include that in the program.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
So the question is, through mediation, they came to some agreement, but that's never happened. That's never been able to happen since this change in 2003.
And through the chair, I'm not quite sure in the question, but I'm not. If you could rephrase that, I'm not sure what
you're asking. You said that that certain areas have these designated areas, but very few in the state. I'm asking.
And through the chair, and that's because DNR made a ruling that the other areas didn't meet their requirements for the important habitat areas. So there were quite a few that were proposed for designation, and they were disapproved. You'd have to ask DNR more why they were disapproved.
And Representative Wilson, if you remember from the previous, that there were 490 that were developed under the guidelines, and then only 210 of those were approved. So there's the majority of the enforceable policies that were even submitted under direction from after the changes, and less than half of those were finally approved. So we'll get a listing of those that were disallowed, and so we can see them at our next time.
Disallowed and why they were disallowed?
Yeah. We'll see if we can get that from DNR. Reverend Feige, did you have a question?
Okay, well, these the agencies that have the authority to manage the particular matters within those districts, they're staffed with, one hopes, people with expertise mm-hmm. and history and the academic credentials to make those decisions. To write their regulations and to evaluate whether or not how a particular activity should be regulated, they have a fairly considerable investment in staff, of not only in staff, but as well as time. And they have to go through a process to change those regulations. The coastal districts, do they have the same kind of staff to be able to address those same areas? I mean, it seems to me a coastal district is made up of a, it's represented by a board of, I'm not sure how many folks exactly, half a dozen?
And through the chair, it depends on the municipality. North Slope Borough has a wildlife department, one of the best in probably the world. So they would have expertise there. If you talk about a small community, no, they don't. Coastal Resource Service Area that has the boards.
So they're going to have local knowledge. I understand. And I appreciate that they may have local knowledge, and they certainly have the opportunity to input that local knowledge into the program. But why should they be given the authority to write policies when maybe they don't have the staff to fully evaluate those in those districts? And I'm not taking away from the individual expertise of people within those decisions, but overall, across the entire state, why should the time and investment of the state of Alaska be trumped by somebody who can just make a rule on their whim?
And through the chair, I think that is a question for the legislature to answer. I can't answer that of whether you think the district should have that ability. Current law does give them that ability, but there's a lot of restrictions on that slide I showed you. If they miss any one of these, that policy would be disapproved. First, the state looks at it, and then the federal government looks at it. So before a plan is approved, it goes through many levels of review. You can't arbitrarily or unreasonably restrict a use of state concern. That's just one of them. So it really has to be something that's a local concern. It has to meet those last three bullets there before a policy could be approved. So we're not talking about a district second-guessing an agency. It's really adding something to it that is a local concern.
And I think that we're going to get into a debate here as whether local or statewide. So let's go on through the presentation to make sure that we get there. Was there any more on the areas? I think we're on slide 8.
Okay.
Is that where we are?
So here's another requirement that's more stringent, is that in order to have some policies, the district must actually establish a designated area. And many of the districts have had difficulties getting those areas approved. I think I talked about the three small important habitat areas. I got my numbers a little wrong there. I think it's 11 policies in Juneau and 13 total for important habitat. I looked that up again this morning and would revise that. The subsistence areas, you've heard some statistics in the legislative audit. I might look at it a slightly different way and say that if you look at the total area, coastal area of the coastal districts, the three largest, or 52% of all of that coastal area, there hasn't been one subsistence use area approved in those areas. So that's pretty much from the Yukon, Kuskokwim up north. Very heavily interested in subsistence. Some districts, that's their number one concern. They're not allowed to have, their subsistence areas weren't approved, so now they can't even bring up an issue during a review about an impact or potential impact to a subsistence use area. Again, this is a case where I believe the regulations are more stringent than what was intended by the legislature. And I'll repeat that one more time because it is quite profound. They can't, during the review starts, if they don't have a designated area, they can't even submit a comment about potential impacts of subsistence. That's just off the table totally.
Representative Wilson?
But that is something that's three districts that have been denied their subsistence, where all the other districts have gotten their subsistence.
And through the chair, not every district asked for subsistence areas. Some, either they don't have concerns or they gave up early on. Four of the largest districts, they have no subsistence areas.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
I just want to know where, so it's in the pre-phase that they get that hammered out, and if they say no, then it can't be mentioned the rest of the time. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. There is a provision that during a review you can designate a subsistence use area, but my understanding is that's only occurred very few times, and some of those they denied them even during the review.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It says here on your slide only three subsistence policies have been approved statewide. Where are those?
You might catch me off guard on that. I believe one is in the Kenai. There's a special management area in the Kenai. And then the one would be Lake and Peninsula Borough, and the third one I'm just blanking on right now.
We can ask DNR to get back to us.
I believe it's in a letter from the director of DCOM to the committee. I believe he
okay. stated the three. But there are subsistence areas that have been approved. So districts have been able to rise to meet the requirements of the ACMP legislation. What are the areas that have been denied?
And through the chair, those are the some of the largest coastal districts. I'll take North Slope, for instance. It's the size of Minnesota. And so what they're required to do, and maybe I'll get to this in a slide in just a minute if I can get the details, but they're required to identify every different type of subsistence, every single place that occurs.
Yeah, let's keep going on the slide.
The designated areas, the audit found that that did reduce the ability of the state to influence some federal decisions, because the designated areas only apply to non-federal land. If you didn't have the designated areas, the federal act allows the state to talk about impacts to coastal resources and uses, even when they're on federal lands or waters. But the designated area requirement reduces the state's rights because it limits the impact consideration of impacts to non-federal land.
Reverend Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what bothers me about this is that subsistence areas have been approved. So it doesn't appear that there's anything wrong with the system. The three areas I believe you're talking about are the Northwest Arctic Borough, North Slope, and what, Bering Straits?
Bering Straits, and through the chair of Snail Area, the largest coastal district is the Yukon-Kuskokwim River.
Why haven't they been able to get a plan approved?
And through the chair, it's because, in my opinion, the restrictions are too onerous. And for areas, for instance, the Bering Straits, I did work on that plan, and I worked with Fish and Game, and they said, we don't have this kind of information that would be required for approval. So according to Fish and Game, that information is not even available for the whole Bering Straits region.
So is there an effort underway to obtain that information for the coastal districts?
And through the chair, I believe Bering Straits has asked at least on three different occasions for funding to do that and had been denied each time. They just got their program up and running, so they might try again to get some funding to do that.
Okay, and we'll go on and hit subsistence on the next page.
One quick one, designated area requirement was recommended. The federal evaluation in 2008 recommended DNR reevaluate that. Is that a good thing or not? The legislative audit did the same thing, and DNR's own draft regulations in 2008 would have eliminated that designated area requirement. So I think there's general recognition it's just not working. And I won't go through all of this, but this is just one example of how the rules for the subsistence areas had changed throughout time. 2005, when the district started to do their plans, it was really clear that you could establish your entire coastal district as a subsistence use area. And then somewhere along the line, the rules changed. Even though the regulation didn't change, the interpretation of that regulation changed to mean you have to designate each type of subsistence use. And then in an email, anyhow, most of this stuff isn't written down. You're lucky if you get it in an email. It was clear that the districts could determine which types of subsistence use to designate. As we progressed further on, DNR said, no, we must approve the types, and we can't give you a list of the types. You have to give them to us, and we'll tell you whether or not those are approvable. And then it was something about you have to reflect the species' life history. To this day, I don't know what that means about a type of subsistence use, how that would be linked to a species' life history. It's confusing to me. They did say if you map it, you have to have a scale of 1 to 250,000. So something like the Northwest Arctic Borough, that's 68 maps. But then later, when they went through their process, they're no longer funded at this time. DNR then said, well, it's too confusing, too many different types on one map, so you have to do four maps per quadrangle. So, and that's where they came up with the 68 maps. I'm sorry, there's less than quadrangles than that. And then just recently, last year, DNR came up with a new rule without consulting the districts that the new scale has to be 1 to 63,360. And this is just astounding, but for the Northwest Arctic Borough, that would mean they'd have to come up with 2,108 new maps. Last I checked, it's about $40 a map to print, even to produce them. So we're talking about astronomical costs that just aren't reasonable. And this is just one of the examples of how things change throughout time. Same regulation, but it keeps getting interpreted differently. Every time the district breaches it, they raise it up again. That's my perspective, anyhow.
Okay.
I'm not going to get into the detail on all of these, but a lot of the statewide standards were weakened both in the scope of what could be covered and the geographic coverage. A good example would be the habitat standard for offshore areas. As it's written now, you can't even talk about the impacts to the habitat you can only talk about impacts to competing uses, like subsistence fishing, commercial fishing, things like that. So the mining standard was changed to just a sand and gravel standard right in the saltwater area. And if I can just give a quick example here, and this one's kind of hard to see, but this is the coastline along here. This is the 3-mile limit. And then these are some anadromous fish streams. So the coastal zone goes up 1-mile buffer on either side of anadromous fish streams. And pre-2003, you could address habitat impacts all within the coastal zone. Now, through regulation, not even statute, by changing the habitat standard, this is the small area that you can consider impacts now, is just right along the coast of a wetland, drains directly to saltwater, a 100-foot buffer upper on the upper rivers, I think 500 in the delta. So through regulation, I mean, this is pretty dramatic. You can see that you can only address impacts to habitat inland of that if you have an important habitat area. And again, only 3 districts have very small areas approved. So that's sort of I think something that most people don't.
Okay, we're going to try and get through the slides here, and then we'll follow up questions then.
Okay, carve-out, I think we already talked a little bit. I think some districts would say everything's related to air and water quality. It's really confusing to everybody now that it's carved out. One example might be if there's an oil and gas offshore project, districts might be interested in the impacts of an oil spill on subsistence. To my knowledge, there are no laws about that. So during the DEC review, you wouldn't even be able to address that. But you can't address it at all during the ACMP review. So this is just a summary of some of the effects. On the centralized decision making, I didn't talk about that, but pretty much it's one person in DNR now makes the ultimate decision on anything. And I think the audit even found that that has led to a lack of consensus building during the reviews. Some possible statutory changes. The criteria could be clarified in the statutes, even though in regulations it's I think if you read the regulations, you would think you should be able to have policies. Checks and balances. Some people have asked for a coastal policy board. Others have said move the agency or with the elevations, have all 3 resource agency commissioners make the decision rather than just the DNR commissioner. Those are just some options. The DEC carve-out, one thing I should mention is that when this was explained to the legislature in 2003, very clearly the administration said districts could have policies to fill the gaps in DEC's regulations and statutes. In fact, I think they added the words for those purposes in the act specifically to allow that. No air or water quality policies have ever been approved, whether or not there's a DEC regulation. And then as far as the timeline, that 90-day time limit, in my perspective, for very large projects, that's not workable. It probably is workable for most of the other projects. And then last slide is some possible regulatory changes. While these things could be done through regulation, I haven't heard any political will to do that other than to revise the ABC list and change the consistency review regulations. I haven't heard of any commitment to address any of these issues. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Okay, and will you be available on Friday?
Yes.
Okay, then we'll continue back for questions there. Just so that everybody in the public has, do we have copies of the CS? Does everybody have that? Could you pass that out? We have a CS which incorporates a number of changes that I want to make sure everybody has time. So I'll move this CS, and would you object for discussion? So we'll have it on the table. Okay, so we've got an objection for discussion. So we have a work draft on the table that we will take up at the next meeting. People will have time to study it. We'll get around sectional analysis soon so that we have time to look at these things and go from there. Representative Wilson, did you have another question?
I have a request.
Yes.
Can we, at the I mean, there, because I don't know, there may be reasons that we don't understand about this. Can we have the department come back and go through this same thing and explain to us why or why not this
sure.
is?
That's the intention. We'll have the department in here, and they can give their perspective on that. We got held up on the floor today, and we ran out of time. And so there, we didn't have public testimony. We had our presentation on how the program works, what the district see as some of the problems, and we will have next time a spreadsheet of all the district comments. I think you've all gotten those in your office. We've already distributed all the information we got from the district. And with that, any other comments? We will have both Mr. Gray and the department ready to work on these, and we'll have public testimony on Friday. So we'll be adjourned at 3:05.